Hello everyone, my name is Frank, and today I will be reading from Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche, part 1 of Prejudices of Philosophers. So in part 1, we start with the will to truth, which will still tempt us to many a venture, that famous truthfulness of which all philosophers so far have spoken with respect. So, of course, for many of us, or at least some of us, there is a will to want to know the truth. And that's why he's saying the will to truth, which will still tempt many a venture, will tempt us to many a venture. So many people will go along this path to find truthfulness. And then obviously that's the famous truthfulness of which all philosophers so far have spoken with respect, because all philosophers want to know the truth. That's the whole point. They're trying to find the meaning of everything. So what questions has this will to truth not laid before us? What strange, wicked, questionable questions it has led us to ask various questions that we probably would never have asked before, but these questions need to be asked in order to find the truth. So that is a long story even now, and yet it seems as if it has scarcely begun. And since earliest records, there have been civilizations, religions, philosophers, whatever it may be that's trying to uncover the truth about life, what it means, where we came from, where we're going, what's good, what's evil, if that even exists, ethics, etc. Is it any wonder that we should finally become suspicious, lose patience, and turn away impatiently? That we should finally learn from the Sphinx to ask questions too? Who is it really that puts questions in us here? So who is it really that puts questions to us here? That's a true question. Like, what is it? Why do we even have questions? Why are we able to think of questions and have that critical thinking capacity? Who is it really that puts questions to us here? So then that is saying, is there a creator? Are we programmed for programming? Who programmed us? Is it just by chance? But then naturally over time, why would we need to ask questions? Is this just a way to constantly evolve? I don't have the answers, and obviously Nietzsche's just asking them right off the bat because of that. And what in us really wants truth? Once again, why do we want truth? What in us really wants truth? Because there's something that does want the truth, but what is it? Where did it come from? And why do we want that? Is it beneficial? These are questions that he poses and that we all have to explore. Indeed, we came to the long halt at the question about the cause of this will. So we're going to have to take a pause about the cause of this will. Because what's causing the will to truth? Why are we wanting to know the truth? What is the cause? Until we finally came to a complete stop before a still more basic question, we asked about the value of this will. Suppose we want the truth. Why not rather untruth and uncertainty, even ignorance? And that's right, because before the question of the cause, we even need to ask the question if there's even a value of this will. Is there a value to know the truth? Is there a value to have that will to truth? Or is it a deficiency? Are we not supposed to know people who do want to know the truth? Are they plagued and caught up in a frivolous journey that they're never going to find an answer to? So are we putting value on this will? And if we are, then why so? And why do we think there's a value to truth? So why is it not we want untruth, or why do we want uncertainty and ignorance? Some can argue that people do want ignorance and want to stay in the darkness. You can use, you know, Plato's cave metaphor for this, about those who were living as prisoners, only saw shadows, and one finally appeared. I may be butchering this, but he appears above the shadows. He goes out of the cave and sees regular people, and he's excited, and he goes down to the cave and tells the prisoners, like, there's a whole new world. It's not the shadows, but these people have become experts on shadows. They've become comfortable living in the shadows and thinking that this illusion is their reality, and they're terrified to go out of it. They want to stay ignorant. So possibly one can argue that the value of truth differs in everyone, not just the race as general. We all want truth. Some may truly want to stay in ignorance. So the value can be arbitrary. It doesn't have to be certain or, you know, the same with everybody. Some can value it higher than others. The problem of the value of the truth came before us. Or was it we who came before the problem? So the problem of the value of truth came before us, or was it we who came before the problem? So this is interesting, because who of us is Oedipus here? Who is the Sphinx? It is a rendezvous, it seems, of questions and question marks. Did we invent the problem of truth? Because before us, was that even a thing? Some could say no, there's no really truth, lying, there's no deception prior to the human being coming to existence. So did we create it? Or was it innately created before us and we are pulling it from somewhere? And these are questions that are difficult to ask. Difficult to answer. Because how do we really know? So it's an interesting problem that he poses here once again. Because if it did come before us and someone, let's say a creator or a coder of some sorts, made this will to truth and instilled it in some, instilled it not in others, put ignorance in others, and maybe someone wants the value of truth higher than others. Or was it just us and we're creating this and each person has the ability to put value to any word, any will they want? Possibly it all is just kind of a blank slate and human beings have created everything, good and evil. So continue here, though it scarcely seems credible, it finally almost seems to us as if the problem had never even been so put so far, as if we were the first to see it, fix it with our eyes and risk it. So it finally almost seems to us as if the problem had never even been put so far, as if we were the first to see it, fix it with our eyes and risk it. So I'm thinking here he's talking about that there could be people before us that have always asked these questions, and it's not just us who randomly think, okay, now we're the ones that want to ask these questions. We have no, he said, it scarcely seems credible. Like, how do we know? There could be people wrestling with these ideas since the dawn of time. And then once again, that shows that this is just a frivolous matter. Is there no reason to have this pursuit? Is it just going to end in failure? Because one can never really truly uncover the truth. Who knows? And then that's what he's saying. It's and risk it. That's what he means, to risk it, because it is a risk. For it does involve a risk, and perhaps there is none that is greater. Which is true. This will to truth, this pursuit of it, of trying to find the problem of truth, of philosophy in general, it could just prove that it's risky, because you're committing your life to asking questions that seem unanswerable, and eventually you may come to spots where you can't ever have clear, hard evidence to back up your assertions. So there's a great risk here, because you could truly believe something and have this information that looks like it led you to a conclusion and it turns out to be all false. And then it was a foolish venture you spent your whole life attempting it, but then someone can argue vice versa and play devil's advocate that if you do pursue truth, you're showing more and more of how ways that aren't true. Or if you actually are led by the evidence and truly have taken a look at various information from a variety of sources, and it truly is logical, and the reason why you believe something makes sense, and you're doing it in an honest and just way, then that's not bad, it's not a risk. And someone could say, well, you helped uncover things that were false, and someone after you could leapfrog off you and uncover the truth more, so you kind of did. It's like almost, say someone was digging a ditch, and you dug about 10 feet thinking there was going to be a city underneath, but you never quite made it, but someone after you comes, the straight 10 feet down, they just go down 5 more feet and they uncover the city. So it's like you're laying the bricks ahead of time. So it could not be proved to be frivolous and could be no risk. In fact, it could be a great help, and you're pushing humanity forward and pushing this new generation of philosophers. So that was the end of part one. I'd love to know what you guys think. Now I'm going to move to the second part of part one. So how could anything originate out of its opposite? For example, truth out of error. Now this we have to stop at really quickly, because that is an interesting question, because really, how could anything originate out of its opposite? If there's truth, then all of a sudden there's error. If there's love, then all of a sudden there's hate. There's always an opposite. Why is that? And how does it even happen? How could anything originate out of its opposite? It seems backward, one would say. Because why wouldn't more truth come from truth? Maybe it does. But then there's still obviously an opposite. But where did that come from? Is it already a law that's already in place? Maybe the law of the universe, that there's always going to be an opposite. It just divides equally. When one thing appears, the opposite has to appear. And if there wasn't, then are we pulling it out of somewhere? Or is each person making these things? For instance, was truth ever a thing? If one person invented truth, started doing it, then naturally another person thought about lying and saying, oh, we don't always have to tell the truth. And then that became a thing. Or did it appear instantly? It was always there. Because someone could say, yeah, if you tell the truth, there's always the instant to lie. When someone told the truth, the lying was still, you were still capable of lying at the moment. But someone chose not to. But once someone made that choice, then it became a possibility. And if it showed that it proved beneficial to lie at times, then you have the opposites. Once again, is it already there, or are we creating it? Alright, so how can anything originate out of its opposite? For example, truth out of error. Or the will to truth out of the will to deception. Or selfish deeds out of selfishness. Or the pure and sunlike gaze of a sage out of lust. Such origins are impossible. Whoever dreams of them is a fool, indeed worse. The things of the highest value must have another peculiar origin. So he, once again, is trying to say the will to truth out of the will of deception. Like, how is this happening? He thinks the origins are impossible. But is it really? Because I guess logically, someone could say it doesn't make sense. Others can say it does, because if someone creates selflessness, where does selfishness stem from it? I guess there's always going to be a shadow to each action. There's always a shadow, there's a vice and a virtue for everything. So each action has its shadow. Almost like a shadow self, like Jung said. So whether it's a good action, there's going to be a negative action that you could have chosen that's going to be there. It's the shadow to the other one. Same with any bad action. There's a good action, the opposite action that you could choose. So I think the origins aren't impossible. I have to disagree with him here. Because he says we have dreams of them as a fool, but I don't think so. Indeed, worse, the things of the highest value must have another peculiar origin. They cannot be derived from this transitory, seductive, deceptive, paltry world, from this turmoil of delusion and lust. So he is trying to say that possibly it cannot just come from something that's bad, seductive. Like, how does truth come from deception? Deception stems, and all of a sudden there's truth. Why is that? Why is that good come from the bad? So he's saying that it can't just pop up out of nowhere, that it's rather from the lap of a being, the intransitory, the hidden God, the thing itself, the thing in itself. There must be their basis and nowhere else. So here's the presentation of possibly a creator, some say a God, that rather from the lap of the being, the intransitory, the hidden God, the thing in itself, there must be their basis and nowhere else. So he's trying to say there has to be the good has to come from this bad, but it has to come from a creator, because in his mind it's impossible for something so bad that good can spring from the badness. But I don't know, don't fruits and flowers grow out of shit? So that's pretty bad for the most part, but that's another thing. Why do we think it's bad? It could be actually good. It's expelling waste, but we look down upon it. But anyways, I digress. So, continue here. This way of judging constitutes the typical prejudgment and prejudice, which give away the metaphysicians of all ages. This kind of valuation looms in the background of all their logical procedures. It is on account of this faith that they trouble themselves about knowledge, about something that is finally baptized solemnly as the truth. So, once again, I'll read this again. The way of judging constitutes the typical prejudgment and prejudice, which give away the metaphysicians of all ages. So he's saying that all philosophers of all ages, as a matter of the time, they're always going to have this prejudice and prejudgment, that every kind of valuation that they pose, any question, they're going to have a prejudice already and a prejudgment, whether it's ingrained in them, whether it came from their environment, the way they're raised, their religion, that they're going to put these, it's almost like they can't help it, they're going to have a prejudice of some kind. In terms of any question, because you all come with a background. Whether you like it or not, you're going to have some biases subconsciously or consciously. And this kind of valuation looms in the background of all their logical procedures, so it's constantly looming there. Every time they're trying to figure out something, they're going to have that prejudice and bias that's kind of skewing them and turning them, orienting them to a particular path and answer. And it's almost like they can't help it, and we can't help it who try to search for the truth. It is on account of this faith that they trouble themselves about knowledge, about something that is finally baptized solemnly as true. It is on account of this faith that they trouble themselves about knowledge, about something that is finally baptized solemnly as the truth. That's interesting too. So it is on account of this faith, so the faith they have, that they trouble themselves about knowledge, about something that is finally baptized solemnly as the truth. The fundamental faith of the metaphysicians is the faith in opposite values. So metaphysicians have that fundamental faith that there's opposite values, that there's good and evil, that there's a yin and the yang, that there's an opposite reaction for every action. You know, karma kind of thing. It has not occurred to, so it's always there, and that's what they believe is true. That there's a good and evil for everything. It's a vice and a virtue. But it has not even occurred to the most cautious among them that one might have to doubt right here at the threshold where it was surely most necessary, even if they vow to themselves all is to be doubted. So most people don't even pass that. He's trying to say that majority of these metaphysicians don't doubt it. Don't doubt the fact that there could not even be an opposite. And he's trying to say that because there's deception, doesn't really have to be truth. Out of selfishness, should be selfless. But no one really doubts that it has to be. We always think there's going to be good and evil. There's always going to be one action with another. A bad action, a positive action. A positive action, and a negative action. But why does it have to be both? And so he's trying to say that most do not even doubt this, and they have faith in this, and this faith is, it's acting as a prejudice and prejudgment on everything, and they baptize it as true. So for one may doubt first whether there are any opposites at all, so should there even be opposites? But clearly we know that there's opposites now, but did we invent that? Was it even supposed to be, for instance, truth and lying? Obviously we know that both exist out there. And one can tell the truth or lie. You have the choice. So clearly it seems like there's those two actions. But I'm sure you can find examples for if there should even be opposites at all, like he's saying here. And secondly, whether these popular valuations and opposite values on which the metaphysicians put their seal are not perhaps merely foreground estimates, only provisional perspectives, perhaps even from some nook, perhaps from below, frog perspectives, as it were, to borrow an expression painters use. So here's an interesting point, too, that he's pointing out. So, secondly, whether these popular valuations and opposite values on which the metaphysicians put their seal are not perhaps merely foreground estimates, only provisional perspectives. So possibly what we think as lying is actually there is the opposite value, the popular valuations aren't what they seem. There could be higher truth. So he goes on to explain this a little more, so let me, before I dive into it, but it says, for all the value that the true, the truthful, the selfless may deserve, it would still be possible that a higher and more fundamental value for life might have to be ascribed to deception, selfishness, and lust. So here's another interesting point that he's putting up, is that we're taking it for granted that we think the highest good from deception is truth, but could there be something even higher that we're not aware of? That's what he means by like the frog perspective, like we don't ever try to question to see if there's a higher value to this, that there could be something greater than truth that comes from deception. It could be something worse than deception. And same with selflessness, from selfishness, and you know, out of lust, it could be something greater. And that's interesting, because how do you go about discovering that? How would you find something greater than truth? But why stop there? Like, why do we put a stop sign there, like, okay, there's nothing greater than truth, and we all just accept that? And that's what he's posing here, and he's asking these questions, which most people do never stop to ask. I haven't. I don't know if you guys have, but it's very interesting. They may discover that there isn't anything greater than truth from deception, but how do we know rarely do people ever. It's definitely on the mainstream philosophy other than Nietzsche that I've seen so far that have posed this kind of question. Anyways, I continue. It might even be possible that what constitutes the value of these good and revered things is precisely that they are insidiously related, tied to, and involved with these wicked, seemingly opposite things. Maybe even one with them in essence, maybe. So this is another interesting thing. So it might even be possible that what constitutes the value of these good and revered things is precisely that they are insidiously related. So we're trying to say that the value of what we think are great is because they're related to these things, these bad things, that if they weren't related, they wouldn't be valuable. So if there wasn't deception, then we wouldn't know good and there'd be no value to truth. So maybe one of them, in essence, maybe. But who has the will to concern himself with such dangerous maybes? I'm still kind of confused. If you guys know a little more than me, I would love to. So I need to look back into this. It might even be possible that what constitutes the value of these good and revered things is precisely that they are insidiously related, tied to, and involved with these wicked, seemingly opposite things. Maybe even one with them in essence, maybe. So maybe they are tied together without truth. You couldn't have deception without deception. You couldn't have truth. They come together in almost like a package form, and then they divide equally into multiple segments. There's different forms of deception, there's different forms of truth, and there could be something higher and something worse. We don't know. And the value could lie in the fact that they're related to these, is what he's saying, and I still haven't uncovered that. So if you know a little more than I, please let me know. But who has the will to concern himself with such dangerous maybes? For that, one really has to wait for the advent of a new species of philosophers, such as have somehow another converse tastes and propensity from those we have known so far, philosophers of the dangerous maybe in every sense. So now he's kind of, Nietzsche's kind of saying, okay, well, now these old philosophers haven't really concerned themselves, so this is a calling for all these new philosophers that want to come out, that they need to concern themselves with these maybes, that these dangerous maybes, he says, that are not scared to question what we already, or most philosophers already baptize solemnly as the truth, that there is opposites, that the value of these, we don't really know, we may be creating them, we don't, like these, there's a lot of maybes that we have to be okay with. It doesn't have to always be black and white, because the world's kind of gray. So there's always going to be a maybe, and that's the best way to look at it, because as a philosopher, if you're really trying to uncover the truth about everything, you can't be for sure certain on one thing, because things can change at any moment. New information can be presented, a new experience, something else can be enlightened to you. You don't know, you have to stay maybe. If you, the minute you make up your mind is the minute that the search for truth ends, and you can be made to look a fool. In all seriousness, I see such new philosophers coming up. So he leaves in a happy term that he sees these new philosophers coming up in the age, and that they're actually questioning these old values. But thank you for listening. Next time I will go into 3 and 4. If you have any comments, please let me know.